Hello, friends. I'm hearing an echo. It is Tuesday, June 5th. It's June 5th. This is Deanna Spingola, and this is Spingola Speaks. I am still on RBN, despite many misconceptions to the contrary. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today, and thanks for listening to RBN in what is now Studio B. To see the lineup for Studio A and B, please click on the word schedule and the RBN banner at the top of the page at republicbroadcasting.org. RBN is still working on getting the glitches out of the new schedule and the additions to the stream, so please be patient during this process. If any of the listeners have a recording of my second hour from yesterday, please call 512-246-9549. To see the guest schedule for this program, please visit the radio schedule page at spingola.com. You may see a list of the guests together with links to their websites. I also have an email list that one may join to receive a weekly announcement of the scheduled guest and any other special announcements. I have linked it to today's date. For questions or comments during the program, please email spingola1 at yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna at spingola.com, which I do not access during the program. I will take calls in the second hour at 877-488-5350. Our guest today is Garamar Rudolph. His website is garamarrudolph.com. He is the author of the very recent book. In fact, it came out in April of this year, and the name of that book is Resistance is Obligatory, and it's a fabulous book. I already have it. I think I must have been one of the first people that purchased it, and you can purchase that book from the Barnes Review, and I recommend that you do that. It is, as I say, a fabulous book. I have not finished it, but just thus far, I know it's a great book. He is the editor of Dissecting the Holocaust, The Growing Critique of Truth and Memory, and that came out in 2003, and he is also, he has the Rudolph Report. And what else have you written or edited or compiled?
Oh, I have a list of it actually on my website, and I think we have some 200 or 250 items.
Wow.
I'm not going to list them all. Not all of them are books. The majority are magazines.
Okay, we do have to go to a quick break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsor. Back. Our guest today is Garamar Rudolph. His website is garamarrudolph.com, and of course it is linked on the radio schedule page. And you were talking about your website and that you have a list of all of the things that you've written, and it amounts to like 250 items, which is absolutely amazing. You're quite young. But you have apparently been very busy doing this and doing research and bringing it forth, and you've suffered as a consequence of your activities, and you were incarcerated. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
A little bit, yeah. Well, 30 seconds, so 30 minutes or 30 hours?
Just a little bit, like when, how it happened, and how long and where.
Questioning the orthodox Holocaust narrative in Germany is a crime, and as soon as you question it, you'll get yourself in trouble, consequently. I was asked by lawyers to prepare an expert report in a trial of a guy who had, quote-unquote, denied the Holocaust. And in my conclusions, that was an entirely forensic scientific work, I concluded that eyewitness account cannot be correct regarding mass gassings in Auschwitz. And as a result of that, I got prosecuted, eventually got sentenced. Didn't want to serve the term, also because in the meantime, I had published numerous other works for which I was being prosecuted as well, further research, so to say. Everywhere where I published something, the police showed up and confiscated things. So eventually I left the country trying to find a safe haven abroad, eventually ended up in the United States and applied for political asylum here, which was ill-fated. I was eventually, end of 2005, arrested in spite of my having married by that time a U.S. citizen and having that marriage recognized as genuine, but that was not reason for the authorities here in this country to deport me. So I got deported back to Germany, had to serve my old time, my first term, which was 14 months, and got whacked with another trial and verdict, a sentence of another 30 months, which came on top of it. So all in all, 44 months that I had to serve in Germany. At the 1 month that I was in deportation proceedings here in the United States, makes it 45 months. Curiously, the second trial was for publications I had written, authored, published, distributed while I was abroad and in the United States and in the United Kingdom. And in both countries, these activities were completely legal. So the Germans have extended the reach of their penal system worldwide. Whoever they can get hold of doing something which is perfectly legal where they are doing it, get punished in Germany anyhow. So brief, that was, in brief, my story of incarceration.
Interesting. So the same people that are ruling in Germany seem to have some influence in other countries that have not criminalized what the activities that you were involved in. So that that is very significant, in my opinion. So you give us a little bit about your background. You mentioned the scientific evidence that you produced, that you presented. So give us a little bit about your educational background.
I studied chemistry in Germany, ended up with what the Germans call a diploma chemist, which is a little bit between an American master's degree and a PhD degree. It, to some degree, is almost closer to a PhD degree, but in Germany it's just something considered underneath it. And then I went for a PhD studies, got a scholarship from the Max Planck Institute for Solid State Research, and was working on that while parallel to this, I was then asked to prepare an expert report, which was my private work and nothing to do with my PhD research. And so I was kind of preparing two theses at the same time, the official one, which was in theoretical crystallography, ivory science, at a highly reputed German research institute. And in private, I was just doing this forensic historical research. And the one thesis annihilated the other one, so to say. Because of my getting into legal trouble, the University of Stuttgart, which was supposed to give me the PhD thesis, eventually denied me the final exam because of my having been sentenced. So I didn't get the PhD. Some people still call me Dr. Rudolph, but the formal criteria were not fulfilled because I was not allowed to pass the final exam. But my thesis is ready. I actually posted it on my website, both my master thesis and my PhD thesis. I translated it into English while I was in prison. I had the time to do that, so it's now online. That is the background. So as a chemist, I was asked to do chemical research on the question of whether or not it is possible to prove with chemical, with analytical means, if poison gas was used in Auschwitz to kill people.
And you did this, and you presented that evidence. And how did that help the defendant in the particular case that you were testifying in?
Well, as a matter of fact, I did not present it. I'm only a witness, but in Germany and in many countries, the Holocaust is self-evident, which means there is no proof required to undergird that the Orthodox narrative is true. So the courts actually interpret that as it being not even permitted to introduce evidence to the contrary. In the meantime, actually, it started in 1996 that the German case law developed into a direction where it's now actually prohibited to ask in a court of law during proceedings to even ask for the introduction of evidence that could partially or completely refute aspects of the Orthodox Holocaust narrative. So if a lawyer tries to file a motion, and I had that in my own case then, in 2006 and 2007, tries to file a motion trying to prove that my views, my analytical research, my historical research is correct, he, at that very moment, when he files a motion, commits a crime of denying the Holocaust again in court. And these people, actually, lawyers went into prison or got fined for doing exactly that. And as a consequence, no court of law in Germany ever accepts any evidence that is contrary to the official story. So my expert report was never accepted by any court because of that ruling.
Oh, my goodness. That's unbelievable. So it doesn't matter. It's just that they accept that the Holocaust is that it happened, and there is nothing, no evidence, no scientific facts, nothing that anybody can present that would oppose that view.
That
and if
correct.
They do, they will be put into jail.
As a matter of fact, I have done quite some research on earlier German trials. They started right after the war, still under Allied occupation, before the Federal Republic was even established. It went into the time of the Federal Republic of Germany. And right from the beginning, the courts always rejected testimony or evidence that was not supporting the Orthodox narrative. They rejected it as irrelevant, since it's an evidence introduced which does not support the story, cannot contribute to finding out the truth, which was set in stone right from the start. It is rejected as irrelevant. It wasn't actually penalized of introducing such evidence, but it was simply said, well, it's irrelevant. That doesn't prove what we already know to be true. Therefore, it's irrelevant. It's wrong or whatever. But nowadays, it's actually more than that. It's actually outlawed to even ask the court to introduce any evidence that contradicts the officials.
So basically, there is no equality before the law in Germany.
No, truth is set in stone, and you have no right to defend yourself, basically. I mean, you can defend yourself by saying, I didn't do it, but how can you do it if your name's on a publication? It's ridiculous. So getting a court to accept that you actually have the right to defend yourself on the matters of the deed, the facts of the deed, so that my claims are correct, is impossible in Germany. It's a dogma, a state dogma, and you cannot challenge it.
This was true back in 1945 also with the Allied occupation?
Well, if you look into the proceedings, they are talking about the International Military Tribunal or the Nuremberg Tribunals or other tribunals which were conducted by the victorious powers. Legal constraints there were even worse. You've had forced witnesses, you had torture, you had show trials to an extreme degree. Today, the legal framework is much more sophisticated. There is no torture anymore. There is no obvious forgery of documents, which happened back right after the war as well. So the way truth was established during the first years after the war with the Allied tribunals can basically be understood if you look into the rules that the courts themselves gave. The Allied, it's the London agreement that basically was Article 19 or 21, basically says that anything that the court deems to be appropriate can be accepted as evidence, and anything that is self-evident and known already to be fact cannot be challenged, is accepted right away as truth. For instance, if the Soviet Union, which wasn't exactly a country that was abiding by rules of law, introduced some propaganda report claiming all sorts of atrocities committed by Germans, it had to be accepted as evidence without being able to challenge.
All righty, we do have to take a break. We will be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. Our guest today is Garamar Rudolph, and he was explaining about the, I don't want to call it the justice system in Germany, because it certainly isn't, but it is just amazing to me. Do you think that, and of course you were talking about how the Allies kind of set a precedent with the trials right after the war. And then we do know that that Germany was occupied for, what, up until 1952. And there are some people who say that, that Germany is still under occupation. And I believe that a certain ethnic group of people after World War I wanted to establish a world tribunal, and they were not successful at that point, but they did manage to establish one now that basically seems to have a great deal of influence over not just Germany, but in America and in Canada and in other places.
Sure.
But, unbelievable.
Coming back to Germany, how independent is Germany? Germany, the modern Germany today is a creation by the Allied victorious powers. As we know, there used to be two Germanys. The Western powers created their part, and the Eastern, the Soviet Union, their part. And Germany became a little bit of independence. It got a little bit of independence back in 1955 and had the choice to become completely independent then when it got reunified in 1990. But then they voluntarily waived a number of sovereign titles that normal nations do, trying to appease the victorious powers, is basically eternalizing the state of being an occupied country. So the Allied occupational forces are still in Germany. They still enjoy a lot of privileges that they have in no other country. And
of course, the U.S. Still has bases there, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true for many countries. I think the United States has bases in two-thirds of all the countries in the world.
Sure, I think that.
All the countries are occupied. But, no, it goes farther than that. That, for instance, the Allied powers have actually the right to keep up their spy network, access to the German telecommunications, and this and that. And so it goes well beyond that. And, of course, you need to remember that we still have Articles 53 and 107 of the United Nations. The United Nations basically is, by its origin, the assembly of the enemy nations of Germany and its allies. And everybody who wanted to join the United Nations while the war was still being waged had to kind of agree to eating Germany to pulp. And that, after the war, didn't really change much. If you look into the Articles 53 and 57, it's the enemy nation articles, which basically say that all the rights that sovereign nations have under the United Nations Charter are null and void when it comes to Germany. They reserve the rights, the victorious powers, to go back to war against Germany whenever they want, if they feel like Germany does any politics of revisionism or revanchism. So there you have it right there, Germany being under constant threat of hostilities being reinitiated as soon as it turns in any way disfavorable or disagreeable to the former victorious powers. That's one of the reasons, I think, too, psychologically, why the German government does everything to stamp out anything that could look like revisionism or revanchism. World opinion is looking with keen eyes on Germany and what they are doing.
Well, obviously, somebody has it in for Germany and has had for a very long time. I mean, they've been the target of the Allies since 1897, and even before. But I think it was formalized in 1897. And to hear you say that it is actually legalized kind of helps to understand why they are so efficient in keeping revisionists from doing their research.
That's right.
My. Well, that is very interesting. And what happens in Germany basically affects the mentality that people have elsewhere. Because if they can come into America and deport a person of a German person back to that country, in the case of Ernst Zundel, who had lived in Canada for so long, and yet they had the ability, the people who are running Germany, the people who are running things in Canada, the people who are running things in America, actually had the ability and the power to deport him.
Yes, well, and Zundel's story is a little bit of a tragedy because and Zundel made a mistake that gave them an opportunity to do what they're doing. But they don't depend on mistakes like that because in my case, I took care that I don't make the mistake and at the end the same happened. They just faked it.
Wow. All righty, we do have to go to a break. We will be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. Our guest today is Gerhmar Rudolph. His website is GerhmarRudolph.com. And on his website, he has it is what is called air photo evidence. If you go into the May archives, you can download some PDF files. There are two of them that you can download that cover a very interesting thing about the photos that were taken by the Allies at a very significant period of time. Gerhmar, would you like to talk about that?
Yes, first, I want to mention that my last name is spelled with an F. Most people think Rudolph should be spelled with a PH, so if you type in Rudolph with a PH, you won't go anywhere, so it's Rudolph with an F.
GerhmarRudolph.com.
Air photo evidence. When we are talking about evidence in general, we should know what the significance is of various kinds of evidence. When we're talking about the Holocaust, most evidence that we are confronted with whenever we encounter the Holocaust in the media or in politics, in science, in historiography, is eyewitness testimony. And eyewitness testimony is fallible for a number of reasons. Now, today in particular, if you have an eyewitness today, 70 years after the event, you cannot expect a person that is 80 years plus old to remember accurately what happened back then. But even right after the war, there can be a number of reasons why witness statements can be wrong. Documentary evidence another issue that can be more reliable, but if it's from a bureaucracy that has a certain intention, it may actually be misleading. Now, air photos are documents themselves too, but they're not documents prepared by some pencil pusher in an office with an intent to cover his behind or to cover up whatever a government likes to cover up or to push for. Air photos are made by reconnaissance airplanes, in particular when we're talking about wartime, during wartime, over enemy territory or in frontline areas, and they accurately photograph what's going on the ground. And when we're talking about the Holocaust, we're talking about certain camps and certain sites where mass murder has been claimed to have been committed by German forces. And one in particular that is most famous or infamous is, of course, the Auschwitz camp in Poland. There have been, since April or May 1944, numerous sorties of Allied reconnaissance planes to photograph the area around Auschwitz for the simple reason that it's a very important, it used to be a very important German industrial area, straddling the border between Germany and Poland at that time. And because it had been out of the reach of the British bombers until American forces moved into Italy, it was developed with a fast pace by the Germans, so thinking that they can produce their industrial supplies and weaponry and ammunition there without interference by British bombers. Now, once the Americans had set up their air bases in Italy, this area came into reach, and the Americans, also Canadians, were making intensive reconnaissance sorties and photographing the whole area. And the Auschwitz camp actually is very close by to a very important industrial plant there that was producing artificial rubber and artificial petroleum, which is a very important war decisive product. So the Allies were keen on bombing that plant, and by photographing the area, they accidentally, more or less, photographed at Camp 2, where, as is claimed today, up to 1 million people or even more are said to have been murdered. And the first time that photos of these Allied reconnaissance missions were published was actually at the end of the 70s and 79, and of all corporation as well, actually the CIA that published some of the photos in a small brochure trying to undergird the claim that the Auschwitz-Birkenau camp in particular served as a location of mass murder. And the book that I have now posted online, Air Photo Evidence, is a much more thorough analysis of many more photos, not just Auschwitz, other places of alleged mass murder as well. And is also scrutinizing the claims the CIA made back in 1979. And it has had, back when it was published by the Canadian geologist John Ball, he published that book in 1992. It's called simply Air Photo Evidence. It steered quite some interest because it was the first time that air photo evidence showing clearly what was going on the ground, what was not, was presented to the public and explained and put into context. Unfortunately, the publication was not reissued because John Ball, as all people touching the topic the wrong way, so to say, got himself in trouble and eventually withdrew from public. We've actually lost any trace of him. He may have actually changed his identity to avoid further persecution. And his book has never been put online, and it's been out of circulation. So I thought I'll just post it and make it available again to everybody so that they can judge for themselves what really was going on the ground during those fateful summer months of 1944, when the Germans are said to have killed up to 500,000, mainly Hungarian Jews, in the Auschwitz camp.
Well, what a wonderful thing this is that you have put this online, and you mentioned the CIA, and did the CIA try to? Of course, they weren't out to prove the truth. They were actually. Did they actually add to these photos to make it look like something was going on that actually wasn't?
John Ball has analyzed these photos, and of course it's very, very strange that of all the groups that could publish such a work, the CIA would do it, so that stings already, because the CIA most certainly doesn't have a track record of being a scholarly or scientific association. So, yes, he did find some suspicious markings, which were unclear whether they are or are not. He thinks it is, for him, clear that they are editions that cannot have been in the original. Now, I'm not an expert in air photo evidence, and I would just say I agree with him that at least what is shown there cannot be what the CIA claimed. But in one spot in particular of this one photo that has a relatively good resolution, you can see that things were manipulated, and that is the smoking gun, so to say. There is a group of prisoners the CIA claims is marching to the gas chamber. Now, the problem with that group of prisoners is that they are marching over the roof of one of the inmates' lodging huts. Now, that's quite impossible, of course, for a group of prisoners to walk over on the roof of a hut of one of the barracks there.
That is now, rather ridiculous.
That's a mistake that happened. And the problem is there are a number of air photos showing the same camp. And in earlier photos, this building had not been there. It had been added by the Germans during some weeks in August or September. And so I guess the CIA was trying to patch in some things here and there, and then they copied it on that picture too, not realizing that the Germans in the meantime on the ground had built an additional building. And so this prisoner inmate group was suddenly running across the building. So that's probably the background, and that's how you can catch them. Now, another thing is they try to prove that there are introduction hatches in the roofs of one of the morgues of, or two of the morgues, one of the morgues of two crematoria. Now, the background of that is that the morgues of the crematoria, according to the Orthodox law, are supposed to have been used as gas chambers, and that Zyklon B, the poisonous product, is supposed to have been thrown through hatches through the roof into these underground walls. Now, according to eyewitnesses, they were rather small, and you shouldn't be able to see them on the air photos because the resolution is not high enough. Now, what the CIA claims is, on some of these photos, they're clearly visible. They are patches, black marks on the roofs, and they say these are the hatches. Now, the problem with them is that they are way too big. If you put them in context of the actual buildings, they are some 2 to 3 meters long. They go the wrong way. If you say, well, that may be the shadow of them, not just the hatches, but you can see the shadow cast, for instance, by the crematorium chimney, you know that it goes in a certain direction, so you know what position the sun is. And these patches, they go the wrong way, so it can't be shadows. They're extremely irregular, cannot be anything geometrical that you would build as introduction hatch. So whatever it is not what the CIA claims. And so at least their claim is false. Now, having caught them with their pants down with the inmates running over the roof, it's clear evidence they did tamper with those photos that they presented. And so there are a few other things where they probably have faked it too. There's, for instance, another group of prisoners marching along, and you can actually see it's so badly done that there's a zigzag line of a pen that is drawn in. I would say it's such a bad forgery that I refuse to believe that this was done by the CIA officially or secretly and officially. I mean, the CIA has experts if they wanted to. Okay, 1979, we didn't have Photoshop or any of this. They had to do it manually. They had to tamper with some pens and some color on the originals or whatever they were doing. So it would have been quite a difficult job, but still, give me a break. If the CIA had put its manpower and brain power into it, they could have done a much better job. So I think it was just some out of control individuals within the CIA, that is to say, probably the authors who did that thing, or some people who are working with them that manipulated these photos.
But of course, you know, a lot of people. Well, the CIA and other government agencies do a lot of things, and they anticipate that the population won't ever look at the papers, look at the book. I mean, people publish books that that they anticipate nobody's ever really going to read, so that they can actually give us their entire agenda, and people, the majority of the population, will never look at those things. And so they get most of their news from just little media clips, and they believe what they hear on the television.
Sure. I mean, you need to look at the context, the historical context. 1979, CIA publishes that. Now, 1978 was the airing of the movie Holocaust, which actually brought the issue, the term Holocaust, into general awareness of the American and the world public. It was that movie. And after that, the fire was kept burning by pouring oil in here and there, and that's what the CIA did there too. They say, okay, this is now really something that has caught the public's attention because of this propaganda movie. And now we just add our bit in there, and we say, yeah, what the movie says is correct. We have the evidence here, photos. And then it's going through the media. It catches the media attention for a second. And then already a few months or a year or so later, some earlier revisionists in that time, a German revisionist called Wilhelm Stegli, already criticized the CIA report there and said, well, that's not true. this and this and this cannot be as you claim. But corrections by scholars appearing in some niche publications never get any media attention. So the CIA is only interested in this one big boost of media attention. And if they are being refuted later on, the public won't find out.
Right.
Yet the same thing actually happened again in 2004 when the British sifted through their own national collection of aerial photographs. And I have actually posted that on my web page, my posting on Air Photo Evidence in the postscript. They said, well, we have found in a photo of August 23rd, 1944 that our crewman made over Auschwitz, and this confirms the mass murder too. And the one thing where they said it's confirming is because behind one crematory you see a small plume of smoke rising into the sky. And the Orthodox narrative says that during that time hundreds of thousands of Jews had been or were in the process of being burned on open fires in that area. But if you look actually at the actual facts, what you should have seen if tens of thousands of people were being burned there every day, there must have been huge trenches, huge areas of cloud billowing and covering a huge part of the area. You need to have huge stockpiles of fuel. And what you see is actually a very small spot where smoke is rising. You don't know what it is. Maybe indeed some people died there and the crematorial were out of function. Something was burnt there. It doesn't even have to be corpses. It can be clothes. It can be garbage, whatever it is. It is a small area, and the small area contradicts absolutely the claim that during that time tens of thousands were murdered and incinerated.
Right.
So there you had a short attention span of the media reporting about it. Even the British found confirmation. You know, that was January, a week before January 27th, 2004, they published that. January 27th, you must know, is the world's only historical memorial day that is supposed to be celebrated by the whole world, and that is Holocaust Memorial Day. That's the day the Auschwitz camp, as they say, was liberated by the Soviets. Actually, if you look into eyewitness accounts of what happened when the Soviets entered Birkenau or Auschwitz, you must say the camp was occupied by the Soviets. They came in there, they raped the female inmates and went on a rampage. So the Auschwitz inmates, when the Soviets came, were not liberated. They were just... they changed their prison, their guards. Anyway, just coming up, 2004, this day of the anniversary of the Auschwitz liberation, it was declared a Memorial Day only a year later by the United Nations. 2004, it wasn't yet, but 2004, January, liberation of Auschwitz always attracts media attention. And the British were just pouring in a little bit oil into the frenzy of this year's or that year's commemoration activities by saying, we have evidence that it did happen. Of course, when you analyze it, it says it proves the exact opposite of what they claim. You don't see any trace of huge-scale open graves or incinerations of fuels or smoke.
Right. All righty. We do have to go to a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. All righty. Welcome back. Our guest today is Guillermo Rudolph. That's R-U-D-O-L-F. His website is GuillermoRudolph.com. And you mentioned earlier about the timing, you talked about the Holocaust miniseries, which was on NBC, I believe, and it was, you know, it was quite a star-filled series, and that brought the attention of the population here in America to the Holocaust, and that's where the word kind of developed. And just before that, you had an individual by the name of Frank Collin, who was attempting to head the Nazi march in Skokie, which is a big enclave of people who claim to be Holocaust victims. And that is where he wanted to have his Nazi march. The only problem is that Frank Collins' actual name was Frank Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. So that basically, the whole Nazi march in Skokie was a, you know, a Jewish operation. And it's very interesting, just about everything that this group did was announced on the television night after night after night. And then, of course, you had the 1979 Carter Holocaust Commission, which brought about the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which the taxpayers fund at about $400 million a year.
Yep, and so it goes on.
It indeed
does. False flag operations. I don't know the history of the Skokie events. But I do know we have had similar events. I remember in the early years of post-war Germany, there were Nazi slogans and swastikas sprayed at some point, and that resulted in the first revision of German penal law, penalizing incitement to racial hatred and to anti-Semitism. And it turned out later on that it was a false flag operation by the communists. I think it was from the Czechoslovakian communist secret service, most certainly directed by the KGB, by the Soviets. And then again, I think it was in the late 80s or early 90s, we had a similar event in France, where there were swastikas smeared and slogans sprayed on a Jewish cemetery, which led to the introduction of the first dedicated anti-denial, anti-revisionist laws, and that was most certainly a false flag operation, in that case probably from Jewish groups themselves. So yeah, things like that do happen, and
I think it's there. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, a secret service that can't pull off false flag operations is probably not worth a shot of powder. So why are they secret, you know? That's what they're doing.
Indeed. All righty, we do have to take our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back after station ID with our guest today, Geremar Rudolph. Stay tuned. This is Deanna, and this is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. Our guest today is Geremar Rudolph. His website is GeremarRudolph.com. It is linked on the radio schedule page. If you would like to email a question or comment, please do so at Spingola1@yahoo.com. And we will take calls after the next break at 877-488-5350. Geremar is the author of Resistance is Obligatory. It is a fabulous book. I have not completely finished it, but it is absolutely wonderful as far as I have gotten in it. And I suggest that you purchase this. It is available at the Barnes Review. Just use the link there on Geremar's page to order it. And it is a fabulous book. We all need to own a copy.
You haven't completely read it. What do you think about it so far?
I love it. I love it. I think that everybody needs to have a, I think it should be mandatory reading. I think in as much as the Holocaust Memorial Museum makes it mandatory for teachers to teach about the Holocaust in all the public schools, I believe that your book should also be mandatory reading in all the public schools. I think that people need to hear both sides of this issue and let them make their own conclusions.
Well, Resistance is Obligatory is basically my defense speech in court, and it does not so much address historical issues itself, but rather philosophical and legal foundations of how we know what's truth and what is a scientific, scholarly approach to things, and why the government should not interfere with the truth-finding process and going into all the means of German suppression of freedom of research, of freedom of speech. And finally, I call for everyone's resistance against any system that suppresses our humanity, basically.
Because exactly.
What is our humanity? What distinguishes us from animals? The capability of doubting our senses and systematically looking for the truth. Animals can't do that. And then to communicate what we think what we have found to others. Animals can't do that either. That's what sets us apart. And where government denies us that right to doubt, the right to search for the truth, and the right to convey what we think we have found, whether it's true or not, we all can err. Where government suppresses these things, it suppresses our humanity, and that goes to the core of our being. And that's, I think, everybody's duty to resist any system, any government, any authority that suppresses these very core features of us humans. And that's basically
exactly
what I say in the book.
Exactly. And government schools are the place where people are taught what to think and not to think. They are not taught how to draw conclusions or do any kind of critical thinking at all. And you even have drawings in here. You have a picture of Violet, your dog that you drew in 2007. You
the
are
that's
so talented.
In the background.
Pardon?
The one that's the dog that's sometimes barking in the background. Somebody is very.
That's what dogs do. They bark.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I had a lot of time in prison, so I have to kill time. And one of the things was to draw pictures with color pencils. My wife is actually an art teacher, and she appreciates art. And I started out with a rose that I drew with just a ballpoint pen that I had because initially I didn't have more. And my wife very much appreciated it, thought I had some talent, and kept me going for 2 years until after 2 years she screamed, "Stop it, stop it, there's no room left on our walls." So that's when I got a little bit demotivated and stuff.
That's wonderful. All righty, we do have to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Our guest today is Airmar Rudolph, and his website is airmarrudolph.com. The name is spelled R-U-D-O-L-F. And we do have some callers lining up, so shall we take a caller?
Sure.
All righty, let's take Werner in Canada, Eastern Canada.
Good afternoon, Dan, and good afternoon, Mr. Rudolph. You mentioned earlier in the program about the way, basically, the judiciary in Germany has been hijacked. I came over in 1969 from the old country, and when I left at the time, we could fairly freely speak about all different issues, including, the past, and the National Socialism. But as I say, whatever was available in information, it real information came from the people who went through the time. As soon as it went through the media channels, then it was already manipulated. But I noticed there in 1973, when I had to go back to Germany to settle some affairs because my dad had passed away, between 1969 and 1973, it was like a dark cloud had descended over the people. In 1973, people I knew from before, they would tell me, come by, I want to talk to you, and so, but they always looked at the person that was with me, and they did not, they wanted to talk to me alone. Like they were afraid that they trusted me, but they didn't trust anyone else would hear what they had to say.
Yes, I have actually on my website a paper under persecution on civil rights that's called Discovering Absurdistan that tries to track the dissolution of civil rights in Germany. And you're right on with the time when it actually went sour. That was when the Social Democrats in 69 and then a few years later fully became part or became the ruling party in Germany. Germany has always had censorship laws that were way more far-reaching than what America has. But it always depended on how it's interpreted by the government or by the zeitgeist, if you wish. And when the Social Democrats in the 70s came in, actually the censorship institutions that were in place then, that were basically up to that point only censoring pornography and glorification of violence, were used from that point onward to censor political literature as well.
Another thing, what I noticed there, I would get letters from both of my sisters. My older sister was born in 1925. My younger sister was born in 1934. And their grammatic and everything, you know, it was, nearly perfect. But from 1972 on, suddenly there were so many mistakes, spelling mistakes, and punctuation and everything. And I thought to myself, it's like in they had incurred some brain damage.
No,
this is... look, I like to look at it in investigations I've done. And there is a serious aspect to it about... at the time, there was a lot of fear about terrorists like Bader Meinhof gang and so on. And, for example, the Japanese Red Army, they had released nerve gases in the subway system and so, and there was a great possibility that biological warfare had been waged by the terrorists against the civilian population in order to terrorize them.
Interesting, so, Germer. What are your thoughts?
Well, what I do know is, as I've mentioned, censorship institutions from that point onward were used to suppress political literature. And you mentioned the Red Army faction, the terrorist groups, the left-wing terrorist groups in Germany. They were, any sympathizer of those people were a target of censorship. But also right-wing literature then was for the first time indexed and banned, which had not happened in the 60s and the 50s. So... it is correct that with that time on, and it's gotten worse as we proceed in time with every new terrorist assault or alleged terrorist assault, laws got more restrictive. Like you observe the same procedure, the same chain of events here in the United States ever since 9/11. Terrorism is being used to clamp down, not on terrorism really, because that doesn't work, but to clamp down civil rights. So that's the same that has been happening in Germany, and that has been happening since the 70s, since they had a terrorist problem there.
And then in 1977, there was a big scandal, and the head of state, Willy Brandt, he had to resign when it was uncovered that his personal aide was a communist spy.
That's correct, yes.
You mentioned there about the aerial photos of Auschwitz, and it comes to mind Colin Powell when he pleaded for starting the war against the first the first war against Iraq. You know, when he was talking, interpreting aerial photos, and was talking about mobile biological and chemical weapons.
Yeah, I think you talked about those in 2003.
Yeah, claims of mass murder, atrocities of ethnic cleansing, of production of weapons, even use of weapons of mass destruction has always been a good means of getting the public into accepting wars.
In 1977, when under the presidency of President Carter, when they were contemplating the militaries about, in case of a breakthrough of the Red Army through the Iron Curtain, about using the neutron bomb on Central Europe, and they were willing to snuff out 60 million people.
Yes, what are you getting at now in the context of the show?
So... as I say, there have been a lot of things have been brewing underneath the surface, and
Werner, we wanted to stay on topic, and I really do appreciate your call. So I really always appreciate your call, but we do want to stay on topic. So thank you so much for your call. All righty. Okay, let's discuss these aerial photos and or other things that you would like to bring up. I've been going through them, and they're very interesting. And you talk about, or at least the document that Ball produced, talked about the spies going into Europe and producing all kinds of rumors and indications and eyewitness accounts that were then taken back to the British or the Americans. And then was it their idea to come in and do aerial spying and to collect these photos?
No. During any war, during every war, every army, ever since there has been an air force, has been taking photos to figure out what's going on. So the photos, and that's actually why they are so reliable, because the crewmen then went up there with a mission to photograph front lines, to photograph strategically important objects and industry and so forth. They weren't thinking about finding evidence for whatever is going on. Now, as soon as somebody goes up there trying to find evidence for something, I get suspicious, because if they don't find it, they may fabricate it. No, in that case, it's just regular. They shot hundreds of thousands of photos while they were flying, just because they had the order of photographing the whole area. They weren't looking for anything in particular. We're lucky that by accident, they also shot photos of the sites that are of interest to us today.
Okay. Yes. All right. Okay. You said that before. And of course, all of the they were looking for strategic things that they could bomb, but they were also concentrating a lot on the residential areas and really executing total warfare on Germany in the form of firestorms and that kind of thing, because they were really targeting the population, the citizens also.
Yeah, that's the definition of strategic warfare. If you look into the strategic aim of the United, of the Western allies, or of the allies in total, including the Soviet Union, was basically to reduce the German population as much as possible, so that in future time Germany cannot be any powerful nation anymore in the center of Europe, being any threat or being any challenge or any competition for anyone. You can see that the bombing campaign by Churchill and his henchmen was designed to kill as many Germans as possible. Right, even before the war started, I mean, the strategic bombing campaign to kill as many Germans as possible was, I think, the first draft for that kind of strategy was done in 1932, 1 year before Hitler came to power, and was directed against Germany. So British policy has, since the First World War, they figured out, damn, we couldn't actually crush the Germans completely. We didn't annihilate them completely. They're going to come back. If we've waged the war and the Germans start doing business again, trading again, competing with us, within the next 10 or 20 years, this war was fought in vain. So the second time around, they say, okay, now we finished the job. Kill as many as possible, and they did a good job at that. You know, Germany is much weaker today, because it's not 100 million, it's down to 80 million, so the 20 million are missing or so. And so it is.
Right. And then, of course, they also starved, what was it, 800,000 of them?
Well, after the war, of course, we have German prisoners who were starved, and the German population that was starved due to the ongoing blockade in 1948.
Right.
I'm talking about millions in Poland. I'm not completely familiar about that.
Alrighty, we do have to go to a break. We will be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. Alright, welcome back. Our guest today is Ermar Rudolph, and we were talking about the fact that they didn't kill enough Germans during World War I and expected that they would revive and come back and be competition to them. And so as early as 1932, they had decided that they would go in and kill as many Germans as possible. You know, there must be something extraordinarily wonderful about Germans that these people fear them so much.
Yeah. Well, hardworking, disciplined, organized, and well-educated. So if you get into economic competition with people like that, then you have to work just as hard and learn just as much and be disciplined just as well if you want to compete. And if you're too lazy, well, then the only other option you have is try to kill them. And that's what the British figured out. You look at the economic data of England in comparison to Germany just before the outbreak of the First World War, and you know why this war was waged.
Right, right.
British economic growth had slowed down to 2-3% per year. You look into steel production, coal production, and so forth, which were at that time the parameters that were really decisive. Whereas Germany had a growth that was going through the roof. You can compare it perhaps today with the tigers in Asia and with China. It has before the recession had growth rates, sometimes double-digit growth rates, and that's what Germany had back then. And I think they overtook England with steel and coal production just 5 or 10 years before the outbreak of the First World War. So they were out-competing England, and this growth wasn't going to stop. They were out-competing England everywhere. And of course, England was trying to maintain its huge empire. And if the Germans were taken away, all the markets, peacefully, mostly, completely peacefully, England was in trouble. They couldn't maintain their empire with being out-competed everywhere by the Germans. So they had the choice either to let the Germans partake in their empire, let the Germans take over the empire, or beat them to pulp. And they chose the latter option.
Right. In fact, they even admitted to this. There was an ambassador, Henry White. He was the U.S. ambassador to France, and he met in London with Arthur J. Balfour, and they had this conversation. And basically, Balfour said, "You know, it isn't a question of right or wrong. Maybe it's just a question of keeping our supremacy." And he said, "You know, unless we go to war, we would have to lower our standard of living. Perhaps it would be simpler for us to just have a war." And Ambassador White was shocked, and he said, "Why don't you just work harder?" And that wasn't what the British intended to do.
Well, they couldn't. You know, the British were at that time 40 or 50 million, and the Germans at that time were already 80 million. So even if they worked harder, if both worked the same with the same intensity, the Germans would still have outproduced them because they were just money more than they were Englishmen.
Right.
You know, the second aspect that I mentioned is well-educated. If you look into who received the decisive Nobel Prizes, that is to say in the sciences and the hard sciences, not peace Nobel Prizes, that kind of stuff, but the stuff that really matters in the world, chemistry, physics, medicine, and so forth. Who won Nobel Prizes up to the outbreak of the Second World War?
It was Germany.
If you put together Germany and Austria, so you put together the ethnic terms, you see that up to 50% of those Nobel Prizes went into these countries. That means they were inventing, they were ahead of the science, they were at the pinnacle of everything. So that was the inventions, the Nobel Prizes of today are the inventions of tomorrow, are the market leadership of the future. So Germany was just getting started with the kind of education, the scientists they were producing, the inventors, the engineers. It was getting worse for the Anglo-Saxon world that was foreseeable. So the only way out they had is either step down or wage war.
Exactly. And something else that the Germans did, they were frugal enough to reinvest into the industry that they were producing, even back, you know, in the 1860s, excuse me. And so they didn't rely on international loans. They didn't rely on the bankers to finance that industry. They were self-sufficient, which is a fabulous way to be.
Yeah, but you make enemies in the city and in Wall Street with that.
Yes, and getting back to the Nobel prizes, now they just give them out to anybody, especially the Peace Prize.
Well, that's kind of irrelevant anyway.
It certainly is. Indeed. Well, this is remarkable. And so that is the whole purpose for World War I and World War II, despite the fact that governments say, oh, we've got to fight for our democracy, and we've got to fight those evil Germans. And of course, the propaganda apparatus in the United States in World War I and in World War II, and the propaganda apparatus in Britain, all created all of these atrocity stories to make the population, respond the way that they wanted them to. And of course, then you had the false flag of the Lusitania in World War I. And basically, Churchill says, you know, it's live bait. Just kill a few Americans and they will respond. All righty, we do have to take a break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. Our guest today is Germar Rudolph, R-U-D-O-L-F. His website is germarrudolph.com. We will take calls at 877-488-5350, and please be on topic. We were talking about why the Allies targeted Germany, and there are several reasons, and of course, the reason that they went after Germany the second time had to do with the initial reason, but it also had to do with Hitler throwing the bankers out of the country, correct?
I'm not an expert at this topic in particular. Now, what I do know is that the reasons that are given or have been given and are still given today to save us from tyranny, from dictators, from violation of civil rights, to make the world safe for democracy. It was in the First World War, but it was again kind of the same in the Second World War. It just doesn't hold water. If you look into who the United States, England, and France teamed up with, Uncle John, the Soviet Union, and it's not just that they teamed up with him in 41 when the war had broken out between Germany and Russia. No, before the war started, starting I think in April 1939, British and French diplomats were going to Moscow trying to get Moscow into an alliance, handing them over on a silver platter the Baltic states, Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria, already then, the same basically as they did during the Second World War and during the conferences in Tehran and so forth. So, and Stalin didn't go for it because he knew Germany is not going to go for a conflict if it is completely encircled. Hitler doesn't want a two-front war, so if he knows that he is encircled, Moscow is playing the game of London and Paris and Washington, Hitler won't make a move. So Hitler saw that he's being encircled and reacted and made a deal with Stalin before he thought the British and the French are going to do it. So the British and French already before the Second World War were willing to have Stalin as an ally. Now look at the human rights record of Hitler before the outbreak of the war. We had the Röhm Putsch, where he killed some of his party comrades. We had the program in November 38 against the Jews. And we had, of course, already concentration camps with a number of inmates. And if you count all the victims of persecution by Hitler Germany at the outbreak of the war, we are talking about a few hundred people. Now, if you are looking into the Soviet Union or Stalin's making and Lenin's making in 39, how many people were victims of persecution of that state up to 39? We're talking about millions. So how can you say, and it's talking about democracy, how can you say you're out to save democracy and to fight for civil rights and human rights if you at the same time you team up with Joseph Stalin? It's a joke. The same, not quite as bad, but similar as in the First World War, to make the world save for democracy. Germany at that point in time was a parliamentary monarchy. Most people don't know it. Germany had a parliament. Germany's parliament was setting the budget. Germany's parliament could dethrone the Kaiser if they wanted to, which eventually they did at the end of the war. So on the other hand, Britain, which was a parliamentary monarchy as well at that time, teamed up with the Tsar, which was not a parliament, the head of parliament, but parliament had nothing to say under the Tsar. So what's going on there? You know, saying there, Germany was respecting civil rights under the Kaiser, but most certainly the Tsar wasn't. There was a lot going on from servants, the old serfdom system, and then it was much worse than anything that was going on in Germany. So for neither of these conflicts, claims to save or democracy or to further democracy and civil rights holds any water. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely. And I believe that Kristallnacht, which you mentioned in 1938, was that November? I believe that was a false flag.
Be that, even if you assume it not to have been a false flag and tally that death toll of roughly 100 people onto Hitler's account, it's still no comparison with what happened under Stalin up to that time.
Absolutely. And even in 32-33 in the Ukraine, I mean, there were some people say as many as 7 million, others say it was 10 million, that Stalin starved to death as a result of his five-year plans, and they actually went in and confiscated food, killed millions of animals.
That was designed to crush the Ukrainian drive for independence. The Ukraine, after at the end of the First World War, of course, Germany had, toward the end of 1917, had beaten Tsarist Russia and gave all those nations independence as they have become independent again after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So talking about 1918, Ukraine was an independent nation. And then we had the revolution in Russia, and as a consequence, independent Ukraine got crushed and occupied by Moscow again. And they had a independence movement ever since. And what Stalin did there is simply crushing them by putting them under starvation and killing millions in the process. And that's only one of the mass murders that had been going on in the Soviet Union ever since the revolution. So how any politician, and then of course they had the program of world revolution, how any Western politician could sleep at night teaming up with a politician with a system like that, when they figured out they made a mistake after the Second World War, when they found themselves in the position that Hitler had been in. Hitler had been drawn the lines of the Cold War already before the West had figured out that this is coming.
Right. And of course, you mentioned an American politician, Roosevelt, knew about that the starvation in the Ukraine. And as soon as he got into office, he immediately validated the Soviet Union as a legitimate government. And in fact, well, if you go back even further, Wilson also supported the Bolshevik revolution, supported the Bolshevik, sent money over there, and we're talking a lot of money. So it's amazing. You know, if you really look in history and try to figure out what really went on, you have to discredit totally what the government has told us, what the schools have told us, and look elsewhere for the truth.
You know, I mean, it's not even so difficult. I mean, the things are out in the open. It's not unknown that the Soviet Union was an ally of the Western powers during the Second World War. It's not unknown that how many atrocities were committed there. It's out there in the open. You know, you just have to add one to one to see that. Most people just don't add things up.
Which is what you address in your book, basically.
Yeah.
You know, critical thinking.
That's right.
And that's what people need to do. And, you know, turn off the television and open a book and really start educating yourself.
That's correct. Talking about aggressors, for instance, I mean, people say, well, Germany, how they were treated after the war, cruel treatment of cutting up the country, of expelling some 50 million people, killing 2 or 3 million in the process, and then is the saying, well, they had it coming. But if you look into it, talking about aggression, Hitler started the war with Poland. Fine. That's true to some degree. He started by declaring war and going into open hostilities. Poland has had hostilities toward Germany for the 20 years before that, to some degree or another. that's beside the point I'm trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is when war broke out, two countries attacked Poland, Germany
yes.
and the Soviet Union. So after that, Germany tried desperately to somehow come to a peace agreement. They even said, well, okay, we're going to retreat. We'll restore Poland. We're even going to get out of Czechoslovakia and make that independent again. We just want peace. France at that time was attacking Germany several times, sorties into Germany, trying to provoke them into attacking France, which the Germans didn't react to. What happened during the same time? The Soviets started war against Finland. So they not only gobbled up half of Poland, but then they went after Finland and annexed some of their territory. Next, when the war broke out in the West between Germany and France, basically, and the Benelux countries, Stalin went into Estonia and Latvia and confiscated them. And then he demanded more territories from Romania. So if you declare war on a country for having made an aggressive move toward another country, there would have been many more reasons to declare war on Soviet Russia than there had been to declare war on Hitler. Since after Hitler went to war because it was basically about the ethnic cleansing that Poland was doing against the German minority in Poland, and Poland's attempt to get the city of Danzig completely under control. So there was at least a legitimate reason why the conflict broke out, which doesn't necessarily justify it, but there was a reason. Whereas Stalin going into Finland and then into Estonia and Latvia, that is just trying to regain the illegitimate territories that the Tsar had gobbled up over the centuries. But nobody declared war on Stalin, of course, for good reason, because he was an ally right from the beginning. Stalin was just making chess moves against Hitler. Hitler wouldn't have started the open fight against Poland if he knew Stalin was going to be on the side of the West. For some reason, Hitler was gullible enough to think that Stalin would keep his promise. He was taught differently.
Sure. Honest people typically think that other people are going to be honest also, and it doesn't always work out that way. So in the First World War, the Second World War, their attempts were to absolutely obliterate the German people. They were not successful after the Second World War, so they had to have something else to hold over their head to make them stop doing what they were doing, to totally cripple them, and that was the Holocaust. Correct?
That's correct, yeah. War propaganda perpetuated. During the First World War, they had already minor attempts at war propaganda, minor compared to what we would see then later in the Second. And that was, of course, because Germany was still standing. Germany could still refute itself. Germany had a backbone left. They refuted these atrocity propaganda stories. But after the Second, there was no backbone left. Germany got completely crushed, destroyed, occupied, and all the means of defending itself, even access to its own archives, to its own documents, were basically taken away from them. And then with all the trials and the legal system put up onto the Germans, they are now basically completely defenseless. As I said, today, when it comes to this core issue of German atrocities allegedly having been committed, it is by penal law outlawed, forbidden, prohibited, but to even ask for the introduction of evidence that is exonerating. Not to introduce actual evidence, but just to file a motion. It's a crime to ask to defend a German. Not to actually defend him. Already asking to defend him is a crime. That's
right.
The way it is.
Now, yes, in the First World War, they introduced the number 6 million, and they tried to talk about atrocity stories, and they were talking about the Germans went into Belgium and they cut off all of these little children's hands and all kinds of stuff. And of course, nobody believed it. And so they had to create different atrocity stories in World War II. Now, atrocity stories usually work. You know, if you can't get people going to war over, you know, ideology, all you have to do is use an atrocity story or a false flag where somebody gets killed, and that's how it works. But
We had that already with the first Iraq War. Remember that this one girl that showed up at the United Nations Security Council and told this sob story about the Iraqi soldiers going into Kuwait and pulling out all the babies from the incubators and throwing them on the floor?
Yes.
And that swayed the Security Council to actually give permission to wage war against Iraq, and it turned out to be a complete fake, a hoax.
Yes, she was the ambassador's daughter who had been schooled and trained. Mm-hmm. And she cried, and people believed it.
That's right.
Ah, amazing how these things happen. And, of course, with the ownership of the media, the corporate media, I mean, they can basically twist and spin our perceptions any which way they want.
That's right. Big money rules big media, and big money rules big defense industry, so they're all in one boat.
Yes, and of course you have a Congress that also invests their money into these various companies that produce things that are used for war. And so you have a compromised Congress who won't stand up. There was one fellow in Congress that did. His name's Mike Bost, B-O-S-T, and he just absolutely threw a fit here recently and said, you know, how am I supposed to sign these bills when we don't have any time? And, in fact, he's going to be a guest on our program. But anyway, you talked about backbone, the German backbone, that it just did not exist, and that people are just they actually believe in the atrocity stories, the Holocaust story, that they were supposed to have participated in. I mean, there are many people. Why
of course,
is this?
But that's true for almost everybody in the Western world. I mean, we are raised, the whole culture of Western society is inundated with stories of it. You're being raised with it in Germany, in many countries, in most countries. From day to night, you hear these stories, and anyone who contradicts it is being labeled as with all sorts of invectives. And so if you can't trust in the media as you grow up and become an adult, if you can't trust in the media and the academia and all the professors that is in politicians, if they are all lying to you, that's just not the way you can grow up and become confident of being in the right place. You know, you trust people. That's just the way it is. And learning to distrust people, to have the emotional and the intellectual stability to find out and deal with the fact that maybe most of the people most of the time are lying to you for fear of persecution, for fear of loss of reputation, of status and so forth when it comes to these crucial issues. This is something that you can handle only if you grow up. But for most people, their mind is set by that time and they don't question things.
Right. Well,
I think you need to have a certain structure of personality to be able to question profound issues that you have been raised with and believed in for so long to be cast in stone.
Did you at one point believe that the Holocaust had happened?
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. I was a firm believer. And you know, I was on the same track, you know, these evil deniers, Nazis and so forth.
Wow. We do have to go to a break. We will be back in 3 minutes. All righty. Excuse me. All righty. Welcome back. Our guest today has been Garamar Rudolph. His website is GaramarRudolph.com. He is the author of Resistance is Obligatory. It came out in April of 2012. You may order it from the Barnes Review, and I recommend that all of our listeners do that. It is a wonderful book. I have not read it completely through, but have certainly I have formed an opinion of it. And I, too, used to believe in the Holocaust. When I was young, I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and, you know, I didn't question it. I mean, I was a kid, and then I read Auschwitz, a doctor's eyewitness account. I even decided that I was going to teach myself Hebrew and purchased a Berlitz book. book to try and do that. I bought a Star of David, a necklace, you know, on a gold chain. And
you went overboard.
I did, and you know, because I have this tender heart, and I, you know, I read all of these terrible things, and my heart just, you know, went out. And I decided just in the last couple of days, in fact, I'm going to bury that Star of David. I've taken it off of the gold chain, and the next time that I clean out my cat boxes, I've got three cats. I'm going to bury it along with the solid waste matter from my cat boxes.
Which brings up, do you know what the symbol of the Soviet Union was in the very first year after its inception? Now, we know that later on it was the five-pointed star, red star, but what was it in the first years, 17, 18, 19, and so on?
I don't know.
It was a six-pointed star.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Most people don't know it, but the Soviet Union, if you look at the Central Committee of the Party in the first years, was almost completely Jewish creation.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes. And, of course, we now regard that star, at least a lot of people in America, they think, oh, the Israeli flag, what a wonderful star. And it's, you know, it goes back to biblical times when, in fact, it doesn't.
No,
and
it
now they're taught to hate the swastika. When in fact it was a Christian symbol for a very long time.
So what's the origin of the five-pointed star?
That I don't know.
I think it was during 1690-some-odd that the Austrian emperor, faced with an invasion of the Turks standing in front of Vienna, was desperately looking for all sorts of allies, and the Jewish community volunteered to form a contingency to fight the Turks as well, and they wanted a symbol, and so the emperor came up with the idea to give them the Greek symbol for the first letter and the last letter of David, the famous king of the Jews. That is two deltas, spun and laid on top of each other as their symbol. So it's the Austrian emperor, which at that time was also the German emperor in 1690 or something like that, who created that symbol and gave it as a war emblem to fight against the Turks. It's the origin of the Star of David. That's why it's called Star of David. That's the D, beginning and end of David, turned into a Greek delta and put on top of each other.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much, Germar, for being our guest today. I think you are a very courageous, admirable person. Thank you so much for all that you've done and all that you've sacrificed.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk to you tomorrow.